Welcome to the Self-Publishing School Podcast. This is the podcast to listen to if you're an aspiring writer or an author who wants to be more successful. On this show, you'll learn how to write and launch a book successfully, all from the top authors and people just like you who are doing it at the highest level. I'm your host, Chandler Volt, the founder of Self-Publishing School, the author of the book called Published, and the CEO of selfpublishing.com. For free training on how to publish a book that sells 10,000 copies, go to selfpublishing.com/free training. Hey, Chandler Volt here, and joining me today is Dominic Doan. Dominic, he's the founder of Pursuing Faith and the author of When Faith Fails, Finding God in the Shadow of Doubt. He's got a master's degree in theology from the University of Oxford. If you listen closely, you might hear an English accent, like just slight traces. But he's been a pastor all over Portland, North Carolina, Hawaii, a bunch of different places. Today, I want to talk about he's successfully published multiple books. So we're going to go behind the scenes on publishing books about your faith. This will be especially relevant whether you're a Christian, whether you're a pastor. So it kind of from both experiences, publishing books about your faith, how do you do it successfully? How do you do it well? How do you do it with integrity? And just a bunch of questions around this. We get asked this kind of stuff all the time. We got a ton of faith-based authors at selfpublishing.com. So hopefully this will be a good both inspiration and kind of a guide map of how he's done it. So Dominic, great to have you here. Welcome.
Oh, it's delightful to be with you. And I'm not sure about the slight English accent. Although if I do say the word tomato, that's the one word I ruthlessly hold on to.
If you say what?
Tomato. That's about it.
I heard, you know, there's slight, we'll let the audience be the judge if there's right. An English accent in there somewhere. It's like when people ask me if I have a Southern accent, and I'm like, well, it depends on who you ask.
Right. I think you do slightly. I'm convinced that my book sales would take off if I could reclaim my English accent and get talks on it. You just sound smarter, don't you?
Before we talk book stuff, I'll ask you about it. When you go back home, does the accent get stronger?
It absolutely does. I find myself irrevocably drawn to tea, and yeah, it does. It does slowly. It does creep back. We were there in Oxford 2010 to 2012, and mm-hmm. I found that by the end of it, my daughter actually, she was just five, 6 years old when we were there, and she came back to the States and she had a full-fledged English accent.
Oh.
It was the cutest thing. Now it lasted for about 6 months, but
that's wild.
Man,
that's
crazy.
I always tell people, you know, when I go back home, they say you don't have an accent. And then when I'm elsewhere, they say you have a Southern accent. But I always tell people if I've recently been back home, or if we talk long enough, or if you get enough beers in me, the Southern accent
starts coming out. Do you write in a Southern accent though? That's
yeah, right. I just say y'all a lot. That's it. Right. in the written form. Well, Dominic, let's talk book stuff, man.
Yeah.
I guess obviously you've published multiple books now, one back in 2019. That's When Faith Fails. And then your newest book in 2022, Your Longing Has a Name. Why did you decide to write the first book? What was kind of the poke or the nudge for you to ultimately do that?
Yeah. So the first book is really what happens when you go through seasons of doubt or deconstruction. The New York Times, they recently did a whole article on this talking about how it's a full-fledged movement in our country where people no longer believe, or maybe their faith is evolving and changing. The philosopher Michael Novak, he said that doubt is not so much a dividing line that separates people into different camps as it is a razor's edge which runs through every soul. And living up in Portland, Oregon, considered one of the most progressive cities, as you know, in our nation, I found that many, many people were asking very thorny, gritty questions when it came to faith and doubt and life. And I wanted to engage with that topic. What do we do when we go through seasons of our life where it feels like our faith is failing? And you know this, I think the best writing comes out of our own story. I think it was Maya Angelou who said that there is no greater agony than bearing an untold story inside of you. And there's certainly been seasons in my life where it felt like, man, my faith is falling apart. And how do I reconstruct? How do I put it back together? And also a pastoral heart to want to help people who are going through seasons of doubt and deconstruction.
Got it. And so had you been preaching on this before writing the book? Or was this something that you just said, all right, hey, I'm going to get in the cave and kind of start gathering all my thoughts? Or how did that first book come together?
Yeah, I think there was part of it was just experiential. I'll never forget. I think this is back in 2018, going to Uganda and spending time up in the north of the country in Gulu and meeting with former child soldiers. These were kids who had been kidnapped from their homes and forced into this military that was led by this madman, Joseph Kony. You may remember that a decade ago or so. And hearing their stories of heartache, heartbreak, and of course, the lingering question that exists in your mind at that point is, God, why would you allow such a thing to happen? So there's that element. There's some personal things that I had encountered and experienced. There was the pastoral element as well of just, I want to help people who are struggling to believe. And so part of that was written from my own story. And I share that in When Faith Fails, especially chapters 3 and 4, how I went through a season of doubt and deconstruction and questioning my faith. And part of that as well was spending time at the University of Oxford and working with atheists. I remember the place where I studied was a stone's throw away from the world's most famous atheist, Richard Dawkins, and kind of being immersed in that worldview for a season of life. And some of the questions that they were asking, like, okay, this is fascinating. And it needs to be, you know, something that I engage with on a personal level, which then led to a pastoral level, which then led to me putting out these thoughts in a book and helping people who are trying to navigate those times where they're wanting to believe or wanting to have greater faith, but struggling to do so.
Got it. And how much of the book do you feel like evolved as you had real life conversations with people versus, I feel like this is kind of varies based on writers and maybe even Myers-Briggs. For anyone who knows Myers-Briggs, there's the S and the N on the Myers-Briggs is sensing or intuitive, right? Some people are very intuitive and they say, I know what this message like is that I want it to be. And I'm gonna go and I'm gonna create it with conviction from my gut. And then on the other end of the spectrum is, all right, sure, I've got a good idea of what I want this message to be, but I'm gonna, you know, speak it, talk about it, get feedback.
Yeah.
And from a lot of sensing of what's resonating with people, like that'll help craft the message in a compelling way. What do you feel like was your approach between those two, and how did the book kind of get to the finished product?
Yeah, I think so often, you know, we want to begin with the end in mind, and we have this vision of what a book could be. But what I found is that in reading through books and writing now a couple, that oftentimes the best writing kind of creates itself. You may have a vision of it, but then as you immerse yourself into it, it can take on a life of its own. And I began to discover that too, as I started to wade into these issues of faith and doubt and belief in God, disbelief in God, that there were issues and concepts and thoughts and ideas that gradually began to emerge and evolve and grow that maybe looked a little different than when I first started out writing the book. It's like, you know, when you have a book inside of you, I wouldn't know this from experience, but it's like you're pregnant, right? There's something that's growing inside of you that needs to come out, right? And when it does come out, I think of when my daughter was born, you know, you don't fully know what she's going to look like. You don't fully know the personality she'll take on until she comes out into the world. And I think a book can often be that way. And giving yourself grace and freedom to allow the words to evolve, to allow the chapters to evolve. This was definitely the case in my second book, where I found that as I wrote one chapter, I'm like, oh, this actually needs to be a two-part thing, or I need to spend more time, you know, exploring a particular issue. And that kind of freedom and grace that you give yourself in the writing process, I think, is immense. And it allows books to really take on a life of their own and their own personality.
Mm. When I think as far as faith-based writing goes, I mean, you have an interesting background both in, you know, like academic theology, but then also as a pastor. So kind of, I guess the, you know, I don't want to say this the wrong way, but like the kind of like the logic, analytical, intellectual kind of arena, and then the in-person with people arena. And so how do you feel like, how did you balance that, those kind of perspectives? Or did you lean kind of one way or the other in your writing, both with the first book, but with the second book? And any advice for people who are kind of struggling with that? Okay, do I hit them with a lot of scripture and theology or like personal anecdotes? Like, I feel like that can be like a tricky mix.
Yeah. I think the best theological writing is writing that's born out of your own experience with God. Otherwise, it just comes across as ivory tower stuff, and there's really no connection. Alistair McGrath from Oxford, he said that I believe in God as I believe the sun is risen, not only because I can see it, but by it, I can see everything else. So I think he's actually quoting C.S. Lewis there. And when we understand our own journey through the lens of what God has shown us, all of reality, I think, begins to come alive. And I think the best writing is that which we've encountered, we've experienced in the difficult places, in the valley of the shadow of death. When we share from our story, I think there's beauty there. We just moved to this house in California, and down in my garage, I need to get it out of the box and put it on my wall here in my office. But there's a replica of one of my favorite paintings by the street artist Banksy. Banksy's a fascinating, idiosyncratic guy. I mean, the English Telegraph, they call them mad and creative. It's interesting how the two often go together. But his works are just like provocative and subversive and politically charged, right? And they all appear on bridges and walls all around the world, like literally overnight. You'll wake up and, oh, there's a Banksy work. I remember this happened a few years ago when we were in London. And then right on the wall, you see this young girl, they painted firing a slingshot of flowers at a wall and threw a gun. And he's making this incredible, you know, statement about world peace. But I have this replica of one of his works called Girl with Balloon. Have you seen that one? Oh, it's basically a girl holding a red balloon. Yeah. And then she's released it, right? And then along the side of the wall, it says, there is always hope. Now, here's a fascinating thing, and this is all leading somewhere, but the original Girl with Balloon sold for $1.4 million. And the moment the guy, you know, hit the gavel on the podium, the painting, true story, I think this happened in England, the painting suddenly began to drop into a shredder that Banksy had actually ingeniously built in the bottom of the frame. So the shredder turns on, the painting goes down, and art connoisseurs are just watching in horror. They're like, what is going on? Literally, the whole thing is just shredded to bits. And, you know, people are then like, oh, is Banksy making some dramatic statement about consumerism or, you know, money is the death of art or whatever. But here's the interesting bit. Is the lady who had just bought it for $1.4 million. So like, your painting's destroyed now. Do you want it? And she said, yes. That's the fascinating thing. And here's the intriguing bit. She took those pieces of Banksy's Girl with Balloon.
Hey, Chandler Bolt here. I hope you're loving this episode so far. It's time to go from inspiration to implementation. All right. So if you've learned something, we want to help you implement what you've learned with your book. So what I want you to do right now is go to selfpublishing.com/schedule, book a publishing consultation with one of the experts on my team. We'll talk about your goals for your book, your dreams, your challenges, your next steps, and we'll start putting together a plan. All right. So go to selfpublishing.com/schedule, book a call with the team. Let's see how we can help with your book. It's time to implement.
The painting's worth $25 million because it's broken, right? It's torn apart, but there's beauty that's found in that. And I think life often is that way. Writing can be that way. When we're writing out of our own brokenness, out of our own pain, out of our own experience, it has that ring of authenticity. that's where the power is found. That's where, you know, the impactful books are found, because you've been there, you've experienced it. So writing on theology can get very, very dry if it hasn't been lived out or experienced in your own life. And so personally, I see you got to have the content, you got to have the philosophy, the theology, the history. That's all interesting. That's all good. But it's not just content. You're also going for inspiration. And the inspiration is often born out of story-based information, communication.
Mm-hmm. And it's almost like the scripture and the information does the teaching, and the stories help connect it with the individuals and personalize it and keep it interesting, right? And right. I feel like, so I guess my observations going to church, I'll just share that, and then I'd love to hear how you connect that to writing. Because I feel like, and you know, I do a lot of speaking and travel around speaking stuff, and I feel like one of some of the people I've learned the most from is watching pastors speak. Because I'm like, I don't know if this Super Bowl is the right analogy, but like the Super Bowl of speaking, in a sense, where okay, you as a pastor, you show up and give a message every single Sunday. It's always different, and you typically have no slides or maybe a couple of visual images, and you got to keep people's attention for 30 to 45 minutes. Like, is that right? Like, in my opinion, it's one of the hardest things. It's one of the hardest speaking gigs that exists, right? Because I go speak, I give a similar talk around books, and either it's about writing books for your faith or writing books for your business, or but it's pretty similar, right? And so I just feel like I'm always watching and learning from pastors and how they craft messages. But sorry, this is a long preamble to a question, but I promise I'm getting somewhere. You notice that, you know, when a pastor is creating a message, it almost always starts with a story. There's a story, there's a personal anecdote, a sermon story that then ties into a message that you then have your key points or your key kind of theme of the message. Then you've got some core points that you want to illustrate, and that might go story, scripture, story, scripture, story, scripture, something like that. And then tie it together and have some sort of powerful, inspirational closing story, right? Oversimplifying. Obviously, not all messages follow that framework, but I think that's kind of like the basic preaching framework. And so I'm curious, doing that as a pastor, did that inform the way that you crafted your book, like your chapters and the way that you had the mix of story and scripture or like, you know, teaching? Like, did that inform, and if so, how, and any lessons that you would give for other pastors who are thinking about writing a book?
Yeah. I mean, I think as pastors, you're correct. You're developing, you're creating content every single week. I think it's one of the difficult things of being a pastor. You nailed it. Like, I spent a couple of years after my last book came out and literally just traveling around speaking on that book. And I found like, oh, wow, this is actually really easy, because everywhere you go, you have the content, you've addressed it, you can begin to, you know, evolve it and change it and add things to it, subtract things from it. But it's essentially the same body of work. And then getting back into pastoral ministry and like, oh, a whole new sermon, a whole new content. And of course, there's all this pressure to a pastor. So be funny and engaging and interesting and theologically accurate and new stories. And you can't tell the same thing over and over. Although, fun fact, people forget 90% of what you've said by the time they get into the parking lot. So you can just keep telling the same story. Truthfully, though, you are creating content. And my advice for pastors would be, okay, what's working? What's connecting? What are you hearing from people? Like, okay, this actually is striking a nerve. This is changing their life. What is that? Begin to develop that, craft that, take note of that. For my own personal writing process, yes, definitely. I think my style of communication and writing are similar in one sense. There's that story base, but also the theological element. And for me, it was like looking back over years of speaking on certain things and realizing like, okay, this is an area talking about doubt, talking about our faith collapsing because of the problem of evil or questions about science or the suffering that's in the world. This is something I need to develop. And so what I had to do is actually literally get away for a while, spend an entire month, do nothing, turn my phone off, and just immerse myself into a specific topic and begin to write on that topic. Now, I know some people are different. They can go to Starbucks and like 30 minutes later, they've, you know, banged out a chapter and, you know, there's noise and chaos all around them. That's not the case for me. It's like, I have to get away and just focus. But I also think too, my advice would be observing and learning even in the day-to-day things. I think sometimes we put a lot of pressure on ourselves as writers or maybe aspiring writers, like, oh, I have to have the perfect message or the most powerful idea or something that's never been said. Well, Ecclesiastes says of the making of many books, there's no end. Pretty much anything that's going to be said has already been said. But here's the key. It hasn't been said with your voice, through your lens, through your experience. And that's the beauty and power of writing, is that you have a certain way of looking at things. Take off the pressure of trying to come up with something brand new. Instead, ask the question, how can I give my perspective on this? I don't know if you're a Kierkegaard fan, but he was a Danish philosopher. Fascinating guy, fascinating thinker. In one of his books, he tells a story of two different artists, and both of them were seeking inspiration. One of the artists, he's like, okay, I need to paint the perfect picture. And he traveled for years. He went around the world looking for the quote unquote perfect person to paint, but he couldn't find that person. And he comes back years later, impoverished, frustrated, because he couldn't find that perfect person. The other painter, though, decided to stay in his own hometown, and he found no problem finding someone to paint, because he chose to see the beauty in everyone. Hmm. And I think when it comes to writing, we can have, and this is one of the mistakes I've made in writing, actually, is like this obsession with being a perfectionist. Like, I've got to craft the perfect sentence or the perfect paragraph or the perfect chapter. Absolutely, you want to go for excellence. But sometimes you just got to get the story out there and let it take on a life of its own. And choosing to see the everyday, even the mundane things through the lens of, oh, there's a lesson here. There's something beautiful here. As one poet put it, everywhere we stand is holy ground. Every moment is an opportunity to be filled with wonder.
Yeah, that's cool. And that, I feel like the painter story too is a good illustration of the paradox of choice. And totally. And how you can open yourself up to that in your writing and your painting and your anything creative. What would be your advice for non-pastors? So people writing books about their faith, they're not pastors. Mm-hmm. A question that I get a lot and that we get a lot is just kind of, okay, how much of my faith do I include? So people go either one of two paths. Either I want to overtly write a faith-based book, or I want to write a more traditional self-help or memoir type book with faith elements. And I feel like, you know, for the first bucket, it's pretty easy. This is a book about your faith. You're mm-hmm. going to be, you know, that's obviously going to be front and center. For the second bucket, it can get a little bit more tricky. And it's the question people ask is often like, hey, how much of it, my faith, do I include in this? Do I put it out front? Do I kind of tuck mm-hmm. it in there? Do you have any tips for folks who are in that position, who maybe are working on a faith-based book?
Yeah. I think we often categorize things erroneously, thinking, okay, this will be a book on faith, or this will be a book on unicorns, or whatever you're interested in pursuing. When in reality, if you have faith in something, if you believe in something, it will make itself known. C.S. Lewis, he talks about how in writing and in storytelling, the best storytelling is where the faith is actually, it's latent in the text, but it's not blatant. A great example of that would be Narnia, right? You don't read it and think, oh yeah, this is necessarily a faith-based book. Now, if you have history with church, you begin to identify things like, oh, Aslan and Jesus and all of that. Lord of the Rings, another great example. He actually Tolkien specifically said, hey, this is not a faith-based book, but you read it and you see, oh, there's analogies here. This is redemption. There's light and there's dark. There's these themes, right? You prick it and it kind of oozes a Christian worldview. And so I think, again, this is taking off the pressure of, oh, I have to write a faith-based book or not. Instead, just realizing like it will ooze out of you. It will bleed out of you. If you're writing a book on leadership, you're probably going to take themes and ideas and concepts from leadership that you've gained from your perspective. And if you are a believer in God, I believe in God as the sun has risen, not because I see it, but because I see everything else. It affects your worldview and it shapes the things that you say. So all that's to say is sometimes the best faith-based books are those that don't have that as its main selling point. It's just there. It's in the text because it's part of your story.
Mm, cool. Yeah, there's a bunch of books that come to mind when you kind of give that description. Like a kind of super tactical question around your first book. How'd you get Bob Goff to write the foreword? And any tips for people around finding someone to write a foreword or the foreword process, that sort of thing?
Yeah. Bob Goff and I, we've known each other for several years now. And when I was in Portland, our community up there did a ton of stuff with his nonprofit called Love Does. And he's doing all these crazy things all throughout the world. You're familiar with it. And that story actually led with in Uganda, that was in partnership with Love Does and Bob Goff. So I had that personal relationship with him. And this is where the people you know and the network that you have can be so helpful in helping get a book out there. And send off a copy to him like, hey, I'm writing a book on faith and doubt. And what happens when it feels like our belief in God is collapsing? And what do you think of it? And he read it on a plane. He writes back. He's like, okay, I love it. And he decided to write a foreword. I think just it can't hurt to ask. And you start with who you know, that inner circle. But then maybe there's an author out there you're like, man, the way they write, I think this could resonate with them. You may not know them. You may have zero connection to them. But you just reach out to their agent or shoot them an email or social media, Instagram, just like, hey, I'm an aspiring writer. And do you mind if I just send you this? Would you mind looking it over? And there were some people who endorsed my books, and that was the case. It was just an organic connection that we made, and they read it, and they're like, oh, yeah. Just yesterday, actually, I heard from someone I've never met before, and they reached out on Instagram, like, I'm writing too. Would you mind reading this? I'm like, sure, yeah, send it my way. So I think just asking. Sometimes we get intimidated. We're like, oh, I don't know. They would never read it. You never know. Ask and you shall receive.
Yeah, worst thing they could say is no, right?
Right, exactly.
And then you're exactly in the same place that you already were.
Yeah, exactly.
So kind of a big picture question for you. How do you balance, I guess you alluded to this a little bit earlier, but I'm still curious on a little bit further, double click on this. How do you balance being a pastor, writer, speaker, et cetera? Like what is your average day look like? And is that a seasonal thing? Do you kind of budget out stuff for all of that on an ongoing basis? Like, what does that look like and how do you balance it?
Yeah. For me personally, I have to block my schedule. My wife is the most amazing multitasker. She can do 10 things at once and do them really well. I can barely do one thing well at once. So I have to like block certain times. So the way I structure my day, my week, even the year is, okay, I'm going to have that month and I'm going to do nothing but write on doubt. Or I'm going to take this day and do nothing but just connect with people. For me, that's what works. But again, you know, talk about Bob Goff. He can be like, he's the guy at Starbucks or Disneyland. He goes there, I think, once a week as his office. Like that's where he works. You know, with all the chaos and noise, I'm not that way at
You're
all.
Kidding.
I've got to have a quiet place. No, I'm not kidding. I think every Thursday he goes up to Disneyland and he works there on Tom Sawyer Island. So it's just incredible. So I think it depends like what your personality is like. But for me, it's like, I have to block these times in order to be focused. Yeah.
Got it. That is wild. I'm very similar to you. Where maybe it's the ADHD or something else, but I mean, single track, I gotta be on a single track.
Absolutely.
And, and doing one thing, and I need minimal distractions. My noise canceling AirPods are my best friend. Yeah,
got them on. Yes, yeah, it's so funny. True. I have this jar of water. It's another thing I need to unpack from moving, but it's a jar of water I got from a river, and I keep it sealed the whole time because at the bottom of it, it has like this layer of twigs and stones and dirt and probably dysentery. Who knows what's in there, right? But I have this jar because when it's still, when it sits long enough, everything kind of sifts down to the bottom. And so you have this really clear water at top, and then who knows what else at the bottom. But then if you just touch it, even the slightest bit, it gets all cloudy. And that's kind of how my mind works. Is like, if I'm not still and focused, it's like everything's cloudy. I'm not thinking clearly. But if I can remain focused on a single task for a certain amount of time, that's where the clarity is born.
What a great analogy, man. I'll vote two notes, and then we'll close with a couple of final questions. One note is if folks want to listen to one of the wilder podcast interviews on the podcast, go back and search for the Bob Goff interview on this podcast.
Oh, I can imagine.
It was a fun one, and it was wild, but it was really good. And then secondly, I was going to mention this, Dominic. I'm so jealous of the gift that you have and other pastors have of the analogy, right? The sermon story. It just like when you talk about that glass of water or that jar of water or all those things of just like, it's so powerful, the shredded Banksy image. Any tips on how to get better at discovering those or kind of coming up with those analogies?
I think you just got to try stuff. And sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't. But again, this is where, back to that painter analogy, is you're just beginning to notice things. For me, on an uber practical level, I just, on my notes app on my iPhone, I have a little bucket there where it's like, okay, I just saw something cool, or I heard an interesting quote, or met a fascinating person, and I'll actually just write it down. That's it cool. May or may not make its way into a book or mm-hmm. sermon idea, but it's something fascinating. And life, I think, begins to take on a nuance and a texture and a color when you just learn the art of observation. And then again, yeah, you're trying stuff. And sometimes this is one of it's the challenge of being a pastor, but it's also the beauty of being a pastor because you're trying stuff the whole time. And sometimes it's like, whoa, this works. Yep. And often it's often what you don't think will work that mm-hmm. works, and vice mm-hmm. versa. And then other times it's a complete disaster. Probably most of the time it's a disaster. When we lived in Hawaii, I got to do weddings, and I was a pastor out there in Maui, which isn't, if you're going to be a pastor in Maui. That's nice gig. But people come there to be Maui'd, as they call it. And so I'm doing all these weddings every week, and I'll never forget, man. There was this one, the couple came and they're like, okay, after our wedding ceremony, we brought a dove, and I want you to release the dove. And speech we want you to say into the air. And it's going to be really dramatic. The videographer's there, the photographer's there. We're talking about the wings of love. And they wrote this poem about each other. And it was like this very, very serious moment. I'm like, okay, a couple hundred people there. We're on the beach. We do the vows. And then it's time for the releasing of the dove. And I go down to the basket. I'm still giving some things they want me to say. And then I release the dove. And the dove flew up into the air. But what I didn't realize and what they didn't know is that the dove had actually died somewhere, either on the beach in the basket or being brought to the beach. It was dead. I didn't know that because I'm talking. I'm holding this thing. And I like release it, the wings of love, right? And everyone's looking on, the photographer. So it flies technically for about a second, and then it plunges back to earth, which was like one of the most awkward moments as a pastor. Like, what do you even say at that moment? What was a wedding turns into a funeral? I remember turning to the bride, I'm like, should we bury it? Like, what do we do? So we buried the dove. This is all part of the marriage. It was incredible. But I think sometimes we spend all this time like, this is going to fly. This is going to mm-hmm. connect. This is going to be like the epic thing. And you try it and it's like complete flop. It's like the dead dove. And just give yourself grace for that. Have fun with that. It's like, okay, that didn't work. That was a lame story. And actually kind of keeping track of those things. Again, that's where just simple writing stuff down, like this worked or this was a dead dove, right? We should all have a dead dove thing on our notes app. Like avoid this. But this actually flew. This actually connected.
That's good. We'll call it the dead dove method.
Yes.
You heard it here first. All right. I'll close with this question. We've got a question from one of our listeners named Alex. Many authors find breaking in the Christian publishing world uniquely challenging. What kinds of promotion have you found most effective when it comes to reaching Christian readers? And do you have any tips for grassroots promotion strategies that connect with faith-based publications or media outlets?
Yeah, I think the books that tend to connect, the writing that connects, is born out of a community space. If you're part of a community, either leading a community or a pastor or just simply a vibrant part of that community, you have like a grassroots opportunity right there. People who love and know you, who love and know your work. And then it's all word of mouth, really. I think the power of traditional publishing, and that's why I'm so intrigued with what you're doing with self-publishing, because I think the power of traditional publishing is waning in a sense. And more pressure is being put on the individual author to like, okay, you're going to promote your book. You're going to talk about your book. And there's some beauty in that. Like, who is your community? Who are your people? And who are those who, like a Bob Goff or others, who can come alongside of you and help give life to your voice and talk about your voice? So for me, it was very organic. I was part of a church in Portland, Oregon. I've been there for 10 years and had this community, this network of people. And who believed in the work. On another practical note, you know, I had Bible study groups that were leading up to the release. I had a launch team, had 100 people or so that were a part of that. And we had different events, get together for a barbecue, walk through the book together. And it's that whole Simon Sinek thing, like, right, you start with why. Why does this matter? Why is this important? And getting just a few people to buy into that, they're going to be the biggest advocates.
Cool. I like that a lot. And we're big proponents of the launch team concept too. That's a good one. Well, guys, if you're listening and you want to submit a question for a future guest, just leave it in a review on Apple Podcasts or on Spotify, or you can leave it in a comment on the video version of one of our podcast episodes on YouTube. Just submit the question there. Dominic, this is awesome, man. Where
so
can people
fun.
Go to buy your books and to find out more about what you're up to and wherever would be the most helpful place for people to go?
Yeah, both books are Amazon, Barnes and Noble, you know, wherever books are sold. And then our website is pursuingfaith.org. And we have a podcast there, Instagram, Dominic Doan. And you can reach out through the website's probably the best way.
Awesome. Well, check out the books, y'all, and then pursuingfaith.org. Dominic, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for watching or listening to this episode of the Self-Publishing School Podcast. I know there's so many places that you could be spending your time. There's other podcasts that you could be listening to, YouTube channels that you could be watching. So thank you so much. It means the world. Now, I want you to do three things right now if you found this episode helpful. All right, number one, I don't know if you know this, but we've got a YouTube channel. It's a companion channel to this podcast. All the video versions of the episode are on the YouTube channel. So number one, subscribe to the YouTube channel. Number two, if you're listening to this podcast wherever, whether this is Spotify, Apple Podcasts, number two, I want you to subscribe to this podcast right now so you don't miss a future episode. And then number three, this is probably the most important, leave a review on the podcast. All right. Reviews are super important and help the podcast get discovered by other people. So number three, leave a review on the podcast. Thank you so much. I'll see you in the next episode. If you're on the fence about scheduling a publishing consultation call with my team, maybe you're not quite ready for that, I've got some free training that I think will be really helpful for you. All right, all you have to do is go to register to sign up. Go to selfpublishing.com/free training. When you do, you're also going to get a free digital copy of my new book published. And on that training, you're going to learn the next step. So how to implement with your book. So how to write, how to publish, how to launch successfully. So go to register right now at selfpublishing.com/free training. I'll see you there.